Welcome to On Boys, real talk about parenting, teaching, and reaching tomorrow's men. We're your co-hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink of buildingboys.net and Janet Allison of boysalive.com. The big question we address here on this podcast is how to grow great men. It's right there in our tagline. Real talk about parenting, teaching, and reaching tomorrow's men. And that is why I am so excited to talk to today's guest. He has written a book that directly talks about this question. Michael C. Reichert is with us today, and he is the author of a recently released book called How to Raise a Boy: The Power of Connection to Build Good Men. He is also a psychologist, the founding director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives, and he is a dad and grandfather of boys. Michael, welcome.
Nice to be here with you, Jennifer and Janet, and your listeners. I'm glad we're going to have this conversation.
Really excited for it.
I already told Janet this, and I think I may have mentioned it to you before, Michael, as well, but I love your book. I had it sitting on my kitchen table, and my boys, who are teenagers now, my 18-year-old pointed at it and said, "Isn't it a bit late?"
That's funny. I have a similar story, but it has a different outcome. I lead a group at a boys' school outside of Philadelphia for 16, 17, and 18-year-old guys that we meet about every other week. It's a very powerful group, but I would share over the course of this year up to April 9th, when the book's release date was, that I had a book coming out. I went into the group the last time we met, just after the 9th, and boy after boy came into the room and said, "I'm reading your book, I'm reading your book, I'm reading your book." They're in the book, of course. But yeah, it was very, very powerful for me, actually. I didn't expect that.
There is a real hunger, I think, among our boys, including our teenage boys, to be understood.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I say a lot that in order to become a relational anchor for a boy, and every boy needs that, desperately needs that, the boy has to feel known and loved by that person.
And listened to. And Jen and I talk about that a lot, is that feeling of simply just listening without judgment, without our overlaying adult, "You should, and if you only did this," but just to simply hold space and listen is so crucial. And you talk about that in your book in so many different ways. And I feel, and Jen too, we've talked a lot also about our kids are schooling adults on how they are beginning to change and shift and grow. And they don't want this, this form of masculinity and this form of relating anymore. And it feels like that man box is starting to move around a little bit and shift and break open.
Well, I think there's a California health study that I cite in the book, 2015. They found that 25% of the teens that were surveyed identified themselves as gender nonconforming. And yet what I would argue is that the man box is as alive and well, as robust and consequential as it's ever been.
Yes.
I just think it's chafing more. Boys are pushing more for more freedom to be themselves. And I think we parents are beginning to get that we have to do something different.
And yet so many of us are struggling to figure out what that is. And this is where your book comes in, obviously. I mean, frankly, if we were all collectively doing a great job of raising our boys, you wouldn't have had to write the book, and we
wouldn't
have
a market.
Podcast, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Michael, I want to highlight one aspect of your book that you brought up, a very telling example of these polar extremes that we're talking about, of the kind of standardized masculinity, that extreme version, you called it, of entitlement and self-centeredness and that violent male identity, contrasted with these three men who you spoke about in this attack. And our listeners may or may not know that I live in Portland, Oregon. And just about 2 years ago, right about now, there were two women, young girls, riding on our MAX train, our public transit. And one of them was wearing a hijab. And this man came and started saying things to them and being very aggressive. And three men on that train stepped in. And I might have to have you finish this story. One of them was a retired Army veteran, father of four. One of them, who I know because he grew up in the town that my kids grew up in.
Wow.
23-year-old college graduate, amazing, amazing young man. And another 23-year-old man. And they stepped in. The man had a knife and he was threatening these young women. And they stepped in. And you highlight this, the fact that they led from their hearts and they had this quality of being courageous and selflessness. And, you know, isn't that what we're hoping for all of humanity? And so it was just this crossroads of extreme masculinity juxtaposed with this heart I believe that all men have. And, you know, the outcome was not good. Two of the men died and one of them was severely injured. And the attacker, did he die? I can't remember.
I don't know that.
I think he is in prison.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, the attacker has been charged and is in prison. So that just really stood out to me, that an example of this crossroads that we're at with masculinity that I'm sure all of our, you know, everyone feels.
You know, I love hearing you tell this story from your community. I'm really glad to hear your reactions to it, Janet. It's very moving to me to hear it. You know, we are one of the buzz phrases that you hear a lot whenever we talk about boys, men, and masculinity is this phrase, toxic masculinity. And folks would ascribe to that attacker an extreme version of toxic masculinity, violent, entitled, racist, etc. And I say that absolutely there are bad behaviors that are outcomes of the boyhood that we've designed and that we manage. But I think it's a confusion. I think it's misleading to attribute the problem to masculinity itself. I actually think it directs our attention away from the problem, which isn't masculinity. It is the design of boyhood that produces a whole host of routine casualties and losses of virtue, losses of connection, losses of humanity. We know the top 15 causes of premature and preventable mortality are predominantly outcomes of men, 75%. So losses, casualties of all kinds are routine outcomes of boyhood. And what I'm optimistic about is that we're finally in a position, I think because of stories like that one and our growing intolerance, our growing unwillingness to normalize them, mm-hmm. I think we're finally in a position to say what's going on, that these outcomes, whether it's educational failure or health outcomes, higher rates of risk-taking and substance use, driving without seatbelts, unprotected sex, whatever it might be, the various ways that boys compromise their integrity, even to the point of losing their lives and hurting other people. What's going on? And that's really the point of my book, is first to inform parents, educators, and coaches, you know, what is going on? Why do we have these sad outcomes?
I think you are absolutely right that increasingly parents are hearing stories such as that. We have watched the Me Too movement happen. We have seen men that were at the top of their fields be taken down because they were accused of horrific incidences of sexual harassment and assault in some cases. And parents of boys look around and say, I don't want my son to become that. We hear about these instances of mass violence and school shootings, and we look at our adorable, innocent looking little boys, at least when they're sleeping, and we want to nurture that and hold on to that. So let's start easy. What are some of the things that parents are doing right by their boys? And then let's talk about some of the things that we've gotten wrong and we can do better at.
Well, I do think that we are all mothers, fathers, children. We are wired to connect. That's the nature of our human brain, our human mind, our human being. And lots of parents, every parent I meet, I think, has that instinctual drive to provide a holding environment, a safe harbor for their child, for their son. Unfortunately, what happens is that there's this myth, these stereotypes that prey on parents, teachers, coaches, and frankly cause us to forget that boys are indeed relational. And we all harbor the myth, for example, that boys are the lone ranger in training, mm-hmm. and that if we keep them close, we're likely to undermine their achievement of masculine strengths. I was on a call to a radio station in Dallas recently, and a man phoned in and voiced essentially the fear in a really, really straightforward way. He said, "I'm worried that we are turning our boys into sissies, that we are softening them. And what boys need to be able to do is to be strong, to be tough, like those good men on that transit system, you know, to be courageous, to be strong." And what I said to him and what I say in the book is that strength, resilience, grit doesn't come from a boy who's pushed out of the nest involuntarily too early, who has a ruptured attachment, who loses his relational anchor and is adrift. Strength, resilience, grit, courage, they come from a boy who's held, well held, we psychologists say, who's known and loved, and has confidence that there's someone got his back.
Yeah, that they have that security.
Yep, that's right. You know, what we know about attachment theory, Janet, is that it's one of the strongest predictors of behavior. You know, depending on the kind of separation attachment that I've experienced, I'm likely to reproduce that with my own children. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the better we parents can offer a secure holding environment for our sons, we can hold them close, we can keep them close to us, the more likely it is that they're going to be able to be themselves, to resist the peer cultural norms that are trying to tear them away, seduce them into hyper-masculine, you know, values of all kinds.
So I have a question for you. This comes up often in my work with parents, and it's, you know, again, we're at this generational crossroads, I believe. We're, you know, raising our boys with more of this connection, and yet we're asking fathers to be this relational person with their kids, and they haven't had that as a role model, and they haven't learned how to do that. What would you say to those fathers and to the women around dads who are supporting them?
Yeah, I have a message for both mothers and fathers that really is about the ways that their lives have been influenced by gender norms, gender conditioning. For mothers, what I say is that there's a mama's boy myth that will prey on you, that will cause you to question and doubt whether you really have what it takes to raise a boy to be a good man. And it's going to cause you, consciously or unconsciously, to move away from your son, to let him go. I have mothers who even believe that they need to, quote unquote, build a bridge to the father so that they get out of their son's way so he can join the fraternity of manhood.
And I've heard from mothers who are advised by people.
That's right. That's right.
To spend less time with their son, to push them into the company of men.
Yeah. You know, it's this idea, this myth, that there are secrets to being a man, and only another man can introduce a boy. You know, a lot of the mentoring, male mentoring, ideology is in that direction. And you know, frankly, I think it's wonderful for boys to be around men. My sons have really powerful relationships with me, and they're very different relationships than their relationship with their mother. You know, there are particular things that a boy can learn from rubbing shoulders with his father, watching his father shave, seeing how his father relates to his mother. I mean, there's all kinds of really important models that a boy can absorb. But if the fathers believe that their job is to teach their boys about masculinity, they're likely to be giving short shrift to the much more important nurturing of connection. I mean, you know, my sons and I, we did a lot of special time playing sports, kicking the soccer ball, throwing the lacrosse ball, roughhousing, all kinds of ways that we could relate to each other that were in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But the point really was, we were spending time together. I wasn't trying to teach them anything. I was simply trying to enjoy them and be close to them. What I say to mothers is don't buy the myth. Hold your sons close. If you want your sons to hold on to themselves, you have to hold on to them yourself. And what I say to fathers is, you know, don't believe that the most important thing you do with your son is provide him some secrets or some exhortation to be a certain kind of way.
That is powerful.
You mentioned special time just now, and yeah, it's a topic that comes up in your book. For our listeners, describe what you mean by special time and why this is so important and beneficial for boys and, frankly, for their families.
Yeah, so I describe three strategies for enhancing connection, whether it's teachers and their male students, or parents with their sons, or coaches with their athletes. It's not that what I'm recommending, these three strategies, are only relevant to boys' lives. I believe because they foster connection, they're relevant for human lives.
Mm-hmm.
But they're particularly important for boys for two reasons. The first is that there's this myth that boys are better alone, that they really are the lone ranger. They don't need connection. They're non-relational. I did this global research study on the teacher-student relationship boys' education. And we discovered, lo and behold, that boys are relational learners, that absent a relationship, a connection with a teacher, a boy is less likely to engage in the skill or the lesson. Mm-hmm. That's first base. Now, what was so striking to me about that was that nobody, none of the adults, not the two researchers who had between us had 50 years in education, not the 1,000 teachers that were teaching these boys grades 6 through 12, no one named boys as relational learners. It took the boys to tell us that.
Wow.
My point, I think, really is that we tend to forget what we know. And that's particular to these myths and stereotypes that surround the project of being with a boy. So the fostering of connection is a special relevance to boys. And the second reason I think these strategies are so important is boys aren't necessarily going to make this easy.
I can vouch for that one, Janet.
Yeah. There you go, Jen.
Boys are more likely to resist, to reject, mm-hmm, to complain, to be mean, to be avoidant, to be withdrawn. They're less willing to please in general.
Mm-hmm. And is that, I don't want to interrupt you. No. Do you think that's partly because they're coming up in this culture too?
Absolutely.
They've gotten these messages that it's not cool to be close.
So the corollary of the mama's boy myth is the boy who feels that his mom is actually trying to undermine him. She's trying to hold on to him, and she's trying to turn him into a mama's boy, and he's likely to get teased by his peers.
Mm-hmm.
Judy Chu, in her study that she writes about in her wonderful book, When Boys Become Boys, talks about the journey from age 4 to age 6 and how many of the boys began to hide the fact that they still loved to climb in their mother's laps. Mm-hmm. They kept that secret.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, boys absorb this message and they enact it when they're out in public trying to play this part, you know? And so, you know, between parents who feel rejected and scared, who believe the mask, and boys who also believe it, the more typical outcome is that boys get let go and they lose their relational anchors. Mm-hmm. So I recommend these three strategies. The first strategy is what I call listening or deep listening. The second strategy is the one you mentioned, special time. And the third one is a model for discipline called listen, limit, listen. Listening, by listening, what I mean, it's sort of, Janet, what you were saying earlier. You know, we need to communicate to our sons that we want to know them.
Mm-hmm.
We want to know not just, you know, what they do, their grades or their sports achievements or how well they clean their rooms or, you know, how polite they are. We want to know what's in their hearts and minds. And the only way we're going to do that is if we're able to still our own preoccupations and be present for our sons, just simply to listen to them. And that's especially important in the realm of emotional development. What we know about emotional development is it's a function of practice, and that boys get much less practice than girls. And the reason boys get less practice than girls is that we parents typically don't believe that boys are emotionally expressive. What the research shows, however, is that boys and girls have equal experience of emotions. Where things diverge is in the expression of emotions.
Yes.
Boys keep it in because they're responding to cultural cues that they damn well better. Mm-hmm.
They're watching all of us all the time for, is it okay? Is this accepted?
Yeah. And in particular, vulnerable feelings like fear or disappointment or sadness, any emotion other than anger actually gets censored for boys. So what we have to do is we have to create a space where we can be delighted with our sons, not preoccupied, not urgent, not prying, not controlling, not dominating, but simply there, and trust that boys will test the reality of that, but there's a force within them that is our ally in this project that they will open up once they discover that it's safe.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is the kind of thing that always seems so much easier to me when I'm reading a book or having a nice, calm conversation with you and Janet.
Yeah, yeah.
It all becomes much more difficult when my actual children show up at home. You know, and you're caught in the busyness. You're torn between work and home. And right now, if you came in my house, it would be utterly apparent to you that my kids went on a trip with their dad last week because they came home and just threw everything everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it's driving me crazy. And I could very easily turn all my interactions with them into nagging them about the stuff that's on the floor. But somehow we as parents need to give ourselves permission sometimes, I think, to let that go and sit there and be available to whatever your boy has to say, for instance, when he comes home after baseball practice, instead of jumping right to, hey, you left your underwear laying on the floor again.
Yeah, yeah.
That's your homework. And I think it's good for all of us to recognize getting to those quiet places requires us to be less busy and requires us as the adults to, you know, turn off the radio when you're in the car and be okay with silence. I think we're so used to just having constant commotion and noise around us, but that in that silence, that may be an invitation to speak. Or, you know, again, and Jen and I have talked about this, you know, it might be that you're sitting side by side and the, you know, TV's on or whatever, and there's little snippets of conversation, but that if we as the adults can be more attuned to those little tiny moments, that's when, you know, that's when the magic can happen.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to say. You use the word attuned, and that's a really important word or an important concept, because before a boy is going to go forward with spilling his guts, he needs to feel you and feel that you are present and that you are available emotionally to hear what he has to say. What happens to many of us, Jennifer, going back to what you were saying about the mess on the floor, is that we don't have control of our attention. Our attention is dominated by whatever is presently irking us or making us feel tense. So in order for the boy to get the opportunity to practice coding feelings with language and communicating them to someone, i.e. his parents, we, the parent, have to practice exercising control over our attention, or our attention is going to be in a default mode of just bouncing from stimulus to stimulus to stimulus. So it's a muscle. And what I recommend to parents is that they simply be really kind to themselves and start reasonable and small. Say, for 5 minutes when I pick my son up, I'm gonna clear my mind and simply look at him, locate the place in my heart where I'm delighted in him, and I'm just going to be present. And I'm not going to fill in the space. I'm not going to pry. I'm just going to look at him and let him sense that I'm available. And extend that 5 minutes to 10 minutes to 15 to half an hour. But, you know, build up that muscle, gain control over your mind and your attention.
Your word delight struck me there. Another mom shared in my Facebook group today, a lot of us are parenting tweens and teens. And as you point out, they're not always pleasant people to be around. And her point was, you know, sometimes when we look at our boys, it's what we are feeling is not necessarily delight. But we as the parents need to recenter ourselves and take control, because what if they're looking at us and they're not sensing delight, and that's what they are responding to? And her point was to look at it from the son's point of view, from the boy's point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
And it underscores the importance of this inner work that we do as parents, the things that our kids can't see, won't see, and may not even realize for another 40 or 50 years.
I was giving a talk to a group of parents, and we were talking about the Me Too concerns. It was toward the end of the talk, and one mother raised her hand and said, "Let's be real. What we're all here primarily concerned about is that our sons not become assholes." And everybody cracked up.
I have a blog post about that.
And you know, the truth is that our boys picked that fear up for sure. And we call it the looking glass model of self-concept development. But basically, we are who we think others see us as.
Yes.
And this has been so proven in education, so many studies around that. You know, if a teacher thinks that you are going to be a failing student, guess what? You're going to be a failing student.
That's right. The Rosenthal effect.
Yes. All of this, I just want to interject, all of that gets worse for boys of color and the messaging around what they receive from the world. So again, back to your point, and I loved your word of the safe harbor. We have to create, and it may be that a teacher or a coach becomes that safe harbor if that boy doesn't have a home that can be a safe harbor, but that we as adults can recognize, yeah, that kid needs something. And what can I, as his teacher, provide? Not that we're going to be the saviors or the fixers, but bringing in just that place where, yeah, you know, come and hang out after school while I'm grading papers or whatever, that he has that place to come.
That's that was one of the most stirring findings in our research about the student-teacher relationship, Janet. We actually heard stories of relationships that were truly transformative, that lifted boys up and helped them see themselves in altogether different ways. I actually say that these relationships, when they go well, are transformative on three different levels. They're transformative on a practical level. You gain the skills, you gain the knowledge, you gain the learning that you're able to pass the test and accomplish your goals. Mm-hmm. They're also psychologically transformative. I see myself differently. I didn't know I was a poet. I didn't know that I could run that fast on the track team. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, I think they're transformative existentially. I discover I'm not alone, that there's somebody I can count on. Somebody's going to be there for me. And that changes what we call mental models. Mm-hmm. So if a boy has had a ruptured attachment, if he's been terribly abandoned or disappointed at home, and he simply doesn't trust anyone, he's come to believe that people can't be depended on, it's possible for a present relationship with a teacher or a coach to change that, and for the boy to learn that indeed this world is different than I thought it was. And his whole life trajectory changes at that point.
I love all of the hope that is in your book. For one, and I picked this up right away, I'm divorced. And so I was, you know, raising my boys. Their dad was still involved, but divorced mom for a number of years. And you are one of the very few voices saying, hey, moms, you can do this job. I appreciate that. And that is a message of hope that's crucial. And what you just said now, like boys who have had tough starts, there's still hope. There is a lot of hope. There are no boys who are beyond hope. We can make this better for everybody.
That was our finding in the research study. And it was not something I think we expected to learn so clearly. I'm now in the uncomfortable position of going around to schools and telling teachers, basically, you can't give up on any boy, because the research shows that every boy can be reached by someone with the right strategies. And when that boy is reached, he can be transformed. So it's the right strategy. It's the right approach that makes the difference. And, you know, that's the trick here. And what I say in the book is it really does begin with listening, with carving out blocks of time and deciding that we're going to follow the boy's lead. We're not going to dominate him and require him to fit to our comfort zones. We're not going to teach him something. We're going to actually allow him to teach us about himself. And what boys often will do at the beginning of that special time project is they'll test it. Mm-hmm. Mom, are you really able to put aside your concerns? Are you sure you're not going to wind up just lecturing me or complaining about me or tuning me out or going to your phone? And, you know, once the boy establishes that indeed mom is going to be with me because she really enjoys being with me as I am, there's no need to modify me in some way or fix me in some way. She just likes to be with me. I'm going to feel safer, and I'm going to open up and use that powerful time to reveal myself to her. I'm going to come away feeling better known and better understood.
Obviously, you know a lot about boys on a lot of different levels from a lot of angles. Your background in psychology, your profession, you grew up as a boy. And yet, this is all difficult to put into personal practice. So I'm willing to bet that things didn't always go smoothly when you were parenting your own sons. And now you have grandsons. How has the hands-on experience of living with boys further enhanced your understanding and challenged you, frankly?
Yeah, I could go into long detail about that, for sure. But what I would say maybe in a short way is this. What boys don't need is a perfect parent.
Thank God. Yeah.
You know, they don't need perfection, and every relationship of every kind cycles routinely through periods of connection, disconnection, reconnection. That's true of my relationship with my sons, my grandson, my wife, clients in my office.
Yeah.
What's important isn't maintaining a steady, perfect connection, because that's just unrealistic and, you know, not going to happen. What's important is for the adult, whether it's the teacher or the parent, to recognize that their job is also to be the relationship manager And if the relationship has gotten disconnected or weakened in some way, if it's broken down in some way, it's the parent or the adult's job to fix it. Our keeping coming back is the thing that communicates to the boy that indeed we're in it. We're with them.
Yeah.
They derive more meaning from the fact that they can see it's hard for you, that you are distracted. They know that you're stressed. You're a single mom and you've got way too much to do and too little help, but that you keep carving out time to be with them, that they're that important to you, that they're that much of a priority to you. Boy, is that going to make a difference.
Amen. Yes. Amen. There's that hope again. And there's me still at ground zero, just hoping this all comes true in the end.
I can promise you it comes true. I can promise that. I tell you, it's just there is this fundamental reality to who we are as human beings. We are relational. We're wired to connect. Mm-hmm. And when we don't find the connection we need, we do not flourish. But when we do, we're actually able to be the good, empathic, virtuous men that we're wired to be.
And this is a good place to interject, because I don't want to leave that story of the MAX train without speaking to what this young man said as he, I'll just say, as he lay dying at the train that day. He said, and this is, I've seen it in quilts, I've seen it on graffiti. He said, "Tell everyone on the train that I love them. Tell everyone on this train that I love them." He could, in that moment of dying, his message was love and hope.
Yeah, and you know, there's different ways to respond to that, of course, but how I think about it is he knew that's who he was.
Yes.
And that's what's so important. He knew that's who he was. That's what he had to give to the world. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, what healthy masculinity looks and sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And can I read the poem that the poet wrote?
Yeah, that'd be great.
After he, oh my gosh. So the third man was a 21-year-old poet, and he had emergency surgery. He had a stab wound that barely missed his jugular. And as he was released from the hospital, he offered this poem that you included in your book that he had composed. And he said, "I am alive. I spat in the eye of hate and lived. This is what we must do for one another. We must live for one another." And we will include his name in the we'll include all that in the show notes.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes.
You know, Janet, the thing I would say maybe on closing here is that, you know, counterposed to this notion of toxic masculinity, are stories like that. And there are so many more stories like that than negative stories. Mm-hmm. But, you know, positive masculinity is everywhere in our lives. And it moves us to tears when we see it, because
as Janet and I are both wiping our eyes over here.
Yeah, yeah. You know, because it is so powerful, mm-hmm. so much goodness. We depend upon it. And I just think that you know, in terms of answering the question, what goes wrong, it's developmental science 101. If we violate boys' basic natures, bad outcomes will ensue. If we meet their most basic needs, they're likely to wind up connected to their hearts, connected to their virtue and their goodness.
I think that's a perfect ending right there, Janet. Oh. Wow.
Oh, Michael.
We will definitely include, you know, link to your book in the show notes and your website. I know that you've been going around and doing speaking. Is that up on your website as well?
The calendar of the events? Yeah,
yes.
No, I haven't put it up there, but it's fine for people to reach out to me through the website.
Okay.
Wow.
And, it's great talking with you both.
Oh my gosh.
I'm so glad to actually connect with someone from Portland that shares that resonance that I had with that story.
Yeah.
Thank you, Janet.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of people in Portland that.
Yeah, I'm really glad to know that.
A lot. It
certainly resonated to many of us across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually went and took pictures yesterday. Yes. And we'll include those in the show notes.
Wow.
Also. We will certainly be spreading the word about your book. It is beautiful.
And thank you so much, both of you.
I'm so glad that your voice has come on the national scene because we needed it.
Well, thank you. It's great talking with both of you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Care. Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye. Here. Bye.
Thanks for joining us. We are Jennifer L.W. Fink and Janet Allison, and we are here to support you in parenting and teaching tomorrow's men.